You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, September 28th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, how was everyone's Yom Kippur?
It was awesome.
Nice. I don't remember.
This was the best Yom Kippur ever.
Why?
There have been 5,769 Yom Kippurs prior to the one this year. This one marks the 5,770th, and it by far blew away all the others.
But Rebecca's not with us tonight.
Oh, no?
That's because Rebecca is now in London.
No, she's on her way to London. She's traveling.
I think she's probably there by now.
She was going to go move into her digs and then branch out from there.
I think she's essentially consummating her marriage right now.
Right.
Really?
But fear not, Rebecca has full plans to remain on the show. She's not going anywhere. She's just going to be recording from a different location.
Yep.
Although now she's going to be talking like, hello, boys.
Hello, governor.
Hello, SGO.
How is all you skeptics?
She'll be spelling skeptic with a C and stuff.
Oh, God. That will be intolerable.
She has said adamantly a number of times that she's going to keep the American accent because she, quote, unquote, thinks the English people find it cute.
Cute.
Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, but is she going to be able to really do that? You know, it's one thing to say she'll do it, and then it's another thing to immerse herself in a whole other culture surrounded by everybody who speaks a different diet.
She's too old to pick up an accent.
Yeah, I think so. She was a lot younger. She was in 7, 8, 9, 10, around there. I think she could do it. But now, you know, in your late 20s, there are some people that would, you know, kind of want to pick up the accent, maybe kind of work at it.
You mean like the Stray Cats, Bob?
The what?
Remember that band from the
80s? Yeah.
They go live in England for like 6 months, and they're like, you know, coming back with full English accents.
And they sound like the sound like the Sex Pistols or something.
That's more of an affectation.
So Evan, you know, you could take the girl out of Boston, but you can't, you know,
take the Jersey girl out of Boston.
Yeah,
but you can't. And there's London. Oh, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, it'll work its way out.
So we do have an in memoriam this week.
His name is Basava Premanand. And I hope I pronounced that decently enough. He's from India, and he's a notable rationalist and publisher of Indian Skeptic magazine. And he's been called affectionately the James Randi of India, you know, because he has knowledge of magical tricks and so forth. At the same time, he uses what he knows of magic in order to reveal the godmen of India, or people who are pretending to have these mystical and supernatural powers. And he's been famous for debunking them and calling them out as the frauds and charlatans that they are. And the most famous of those certainly was Sai Baba. We've all heard of him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's, you know, for many, many, many decades has been convincing millions of people that he's some sort of godlike creature with superpowers. There's plenty of video and stuff of Sai Baba and him performing all these so-called miracles, and they're all simple, relatively simple tricks, sleight of hand and so forth. And Basava Premanand is instrumental in calling him out on it and revealing him for what he is.
Could you imagine being a stout skeptic in India?
What difference does it make if you're a fat skeptic or not?
Well, I actually was thinking about that myself, Jay. I mean, you know, there you are, the skeptic, trying to convince the masses. And we're talking over a billion people, right? So the sheer numbers, the sheer volume of people that I'm sure are influenced by people like Sai Baba and these other charlatans.
That's what I'm saying.
Supernaturalism and belief in that, from what I understand, is very, very prominent in India.
Yeah, I mean, Bob, my point is, as bad as we think it is in the United States, and as much woo as we have, like, literally seeping out of the seams here, I mean, India, I think I could build a very strong case to state that India has it even worse.
Yeah, Jay, I was only joking.
It's much more embedded in the culture. Yeah, Bob was making a joke on the word stout.
Because you said stout skeptic, which means
I meant to say staunch.
So.
Yeah, whatever. He's a big man.
He's been suffering from cancer for... They don't explain how long exactly in this article, but they say for quite some time. Carcinoma of the stomach.
Oh, no.
Which, you know.
Metastatic.
Here he is, you know, in the certainly at the very end of his life.
He's literally on his deathbed.
Literally on his deathbed, a time when most people, the majority of people, you know, are mentally preparing themselves for the end and whatever form that takes. And for Premanand, what he just recently did was made a declaration of attitude and temperament, is what he called it. And here's how it reads. I'll read the first part for you. I, B. Premanand, a sound of mind, though suffering from physical complications caused by metastases in many organs, caused by carcinoma of the stomach, herein solemnly wish to place on record the following. I have been closely associated with the rationalist movement from 1975 onwards and have been a rationalist of full conviction since then and continue to be so. It's common for the purveyors of superstitions and such anti-rational forces to start spreading rumors about rationalists turning to God and other supernatural forces, and at the end of their lives and becoming devotees of gods and godmen of various types. I wish to clarify that as on today, the 20th of September, 2009, I remain a staunch rationalist and wish to place on record the following. I continue to be a rationalist of full conviction. I do not believe in any supernatural power. All the powers that we encounter are in the realm of nature, and nothing exists beyond that. I do not believe in the existence of the soul or rebirth. I have not turned to any religion, God, or any sort of spiritual pursuits. When I pass away, I shall be leaving my body, which is to be donated to a medical college, and no spirit or soul to cause problems for the living.
So essentially, this is a preemptive strike against any of the godmen who would exploit his death in order to bolster their own image or reputation by saying that he converted to accept or belief in them at the last minute.
I don't recall ever reading a statement like that by someone in that position before.
Which is good. So he's going to prevent himself and his own death from being exploited by the people that he spent his life to.
That's a bad idea. I wonder how to expose.
I wonder
how these people will deal with it now. I mean, how will they adapt to this?
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if they have a counter move. Because, you know, he's right. This always crops up. You know, there was rumors that Carl Sagan had the deathbed conversion. I mean, you know, anyone famous enough that their name is well known. Bob and Evan, do you guys remember that we met him?
Holy crap! Really?
Yeah, we met him at that World Congress in Albany that PsyCop put on like 12 years ago. He was there. He did this trick where, his gig was to imitate the tricks of the godmen to show that anybody could do them. I remember he ran around the entire audience and put like a little bit of sand in everybody's hand, apparently from his own hand, right? As if he were materializing it.
Mm-hmm.
You guys remember that, seeing that trick?
Out of thin air.
Yes.
So how'd he do it?
I don't know.
Magic. There's a YouTube footage of people pretending to be godmen doing the exact same trick, so you can find it on YouTube.
And I remember I spoke with him briefly. He was, you know, a very like humble, unassuming, quiet man. You know,
I just googled his image, and yeah, I do remember him. Yep.
So we'll be sorry to see him go.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny to think of like to Indian rationalists and skeptics. You know, he is their Randy. You know, he's as big a figure to them as Randy is to us. Well, I want to go to a few more news items this evening before we go on to our interview. There's been a number of paleontological news recently. Last week, we talked about Raptor X. Actually, before we go on, there's a little bit of follow-up to that. Many listeners emailed us to let us know because we joked about, the Raptor X is a tiny T-Rex, and we joked about there being something even smaller called a Nano-Rex. And so many people emailed us to let us know that there already is a Nano Tyrannus. Not a Nano Rex, but a Nano Tyrannus.
Oh my God, that's crap. A great name.
However, the Nano Tyrannus is 17 feet long and weighed about a ton. So it was actually bigger than the Raptor Rex.
Well, what's with the name?
Yeah, they prematurely used the Nano on not figuring they were going to find an even smaller T-Rex.
They should at least go with Micro or Pico.
Yeah.
No, Bob, not Pico. That'd be even smaller.
Bob, at that size, how about, not so friggin' large?
Angstrom Rex.
There is a Microraptor, which actually I'm going to talk about in just a second.
You know, now I'm starting to not like any of this micro-nano stuff in regards to... Wait, let me finish. Settle down. In regards to dinosaurs, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, you got to be careful, especially if you're going to use a superlative. There's something even... bigger, better, whatever is found, then you've used up the name, then you got to figure something else out, right? So here, that's exactly what happened in this case. They used nano, and then they found something smaller. So they just called it a Raptor X, you know, which doesn't really...
Now, they're not going to change the nano Terran.
Now, you know, once it's established, there is a mechanism for doing that, but no one's going to bother.
Well, they can reclassify Pluto a dwarf planet, but they can't fix
obvious flaw. They're really reluctant to do that because that makes the literature hard to read.
You know,
we have a paper describing Nano Tyrannus, and then 5 years later or whatever the time period has been, it's referring to a different species, and it just confuses the literature. So they really don't like changing names in the literature.
Well, they changed Pluto.
they still call it Pluto. They changed its categorization.
Right. Or Brontosaurus.
Yeah, Brontosaurus.
Yes, I know.
And Apatosaurus. You know, I think they shouldn't have done that. But that was different because they had two names referring to the two
And one came earlier, right?
Yeah, so the earlier one gets precedence.
The whole renaming
which is reasonable.
Species and things is a big topic unto itself, right, Steve?
Yeah, taxonomy, absolutely. And now there's the big fight between the, I don't know what the specific name for it is, but sort of the classic taxonomists and the cladists.
Yeah,
cladistics, yeah, right. But a couple of other bits of paleontological news caught my eye this week. One I blogged about, the latest oldest bird. So for the last century or so, the oldest bird specimen has been Archaeopteryx.
Yep.
A beautiful transitional species. The Berlin specimen of Archaeopteryx is one of the most beautiful fossils that I think exists. And I've written about it before because it's such a wonderful transitional species. It's like as if you invented something that was half dinosaur and half bird, that would be it. You know, teeth, bony tail, claws, and yet it has flight feathers and could fly. But it wasn't a good flyer. Do you remember when we interviewed the ornithologist about, I think his name is Prum, Dr. Prum, who referred to...
He did it in the kitchen with the knife, you know, Steve.
Yeah. That there was the...
Professor Prum.
One of the... Professor Plum did it with the bird feather in the conservatory.
one of the provocative, Steve.
Apparent problems with the dinosaur to bird hypothesis is that the timeline doesn't quite work. Now, it's not really a problem. We discussed this with Prum because you're looking at random fossils from different time periods, and because species can be stable over long periods of time, it's absolutely possible to find a fossil that appears later in the fossil record but that has more primitive features in that line than earlier fossils. So it's an apparent paradox. But, you know, you make the prediction. If evolution is true, eventually, if we look enough, we should find older and older specimens. So it's just an artifact of an incomplete fossil record. Well, lo and behold, and Prum pointed out that we've been finding feathered dinosaurs, you know, earlier and earlier, sort of closer to the branching point of the different feathered dinosaur groups, resolving the paradox. Well, now, finally, we found a primitive feathered dinosaur that's older than Archaeopteryx, completely resolving the paradox. The new fossil is Anchiornis huxleyi, and it is from 151 to 161 million years ago, Archaeopteryx being about 150, so it's older, and it's more primitive. It has a very interesting feature. It has fully formed feathers on all four limbs, so it essentially has four wings.
Yum.
But this is not the first feathered dinosaur to be discovered with four wings. One is Microraptor, and another one is Pedopenna. So this is actually now the third feathered dinosaur with four wings. And these are all specimens from early on, in the branching point of the early feathered dinosaurs, the branch that led to birds and the other very closely related branches, which kind of makes sense in that you would think early on, before wings were fully developed, if you wanted to maximize your lift, you know, you would grow feathers on your arms and legs, on all four legs or limbs. But then once the four wings fully developed, the hind wings would become redundant, and then they could be freed up to be optimized for other things like hopping or running or whatever. So that appears to be what has happened. So this is, again, a very nice fossil, further fleshing out the evolution of dinosaurs to birds, resolving this, you know, the apparent artifact paradox of timing in the fossil record. all as evolution of dinosaurs to birds would predict very nicely.
Where was this fossil found?
In China. I mean, all
of
the feathered dinosaurs are coming
where
out of
else?
China. There's formations there that are where a lot of these fossils are coming from. And this is the first Jurassic feathered dinosaur, by the way, or bird ancestor. And the beautiful thing about this find is that it preserves soft tissues very nicely. So you get a nice impression, not just the bones themselves, but an impression of the feathers. So this is why we're learning a lot more about feathered dinosaurs. It's the way in which these fossils were preserved. In fact, this leads me to my next paleontological story. They also found a pterosaur in China in one of these deposits that preserves soft tissue impressions.
No way. It had feathers?
Not feathers, but it was fuzzy. It had like fur.
Oh, no.
Downy.
Excellent.
It could be like either downy or furry, so that they're still not sure if it was more like down or more like fur.
Now, a pterosaur is like the pterodon is a flying reptile, not a dinosaur,
right.
But still a flying reptile.
Flying reptiles, not dinosaurs. Always depicted as leathery wings.
Right.
And
they
may all have been furry, but we never knew because we never discovered one with the soft tissue impressions to tell us.
Now we have it.
Isn't that amazing? Wow. Change all the books.
I can't wait to see the artist's impression. You know, I so hope that there's some cloaked alien probe orbiting the Earth that took video of all that cool stuff back then.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that cool? Furry pterosaurs?
Love to see it.
Didn't see that coming.
Mm-mm.
All right, let's switch gears here from fossils to physics. Bob, you're going to tell us about nanosprings.
Boing.
Yes, I am. This news item came out recently. It kind of piqued my curiosity. I call this one PCNA number 27, which stands for Potential Carbon Nanotube Application number 127. This time, the application may be applied to battery technology. And if any industry needs a breakthrough, I think battery technology is one of the biggies. The attention-grabbing thing here, though, is that the scientists at MIT, who are awesome, by the way, believe that carbon nanotubes can be formed into batteries made of little micro springs, and that these springs could store for example, 1,000 times more energy than steel springs. So pretty incredible stuff. Now, carbon nanotubes, if you remember, are essentially carbon atoms arranged like chicken wire rolled into a tube. This is called an allotrope of carbon, just like diamond is an allotrope of carbon and graphite is as well. Now, in a nutshell, the carbon nanotubes are very interesting because they have very unusual properties at the scale that could provide breakthroughs in electronics and optics and nanotech, even architectural designs, etc. As I see it, these battery springs, nano battery springs, have a couple key advantages that they can offer battery technology. One is what they can do with the stored energy. They can either release it slowly over a long period of time, just like a conventional battery, or they can shoot their load all at once, like a capacitor. So because of that, these are more like a hybrid between a battery and a capacitor, I think. Maybe they'll call it something silly like a bat sitter or capacitory or something stupid like that. The other great advantage to this technology. Okay. the other great advantage to this technology is that the stored energy never dissipates away like a conventional battery. For example, a conventional nickel metal hydride batteries, they lose power when they're sitting idle about 1% a day, as much as 40% a month. Now, the authors of the articles I read compare their springs to a mousetrap. But once you set it, it never needs to be it never needs to be reset or maintained. The energy is stored in the trap spring, whether it's a year or 10 or 20 years, 30 years later. Now, some of the examples that they give for this kind of technology would be, for example, an emergency backup power supply that can be set up and then left for years with no maintenance or recharge or change of batteries. Also, you could use this technology to power devices potentially in incredibly harsh environments like deep oil wells with incredible pressures and temperatures, or in space. How about on space vehicles where you have temperatures cycling between incredible heat and then incredible cold. They could be useful there as well. As usual, there's hurdles to overcome. Wouldn't you love to read a cool science news item and they say that all the technological hurdles have been overcome,
right,
and it will be for sale on QVC tomorrow. Well, not this time, unfortunately. But to make these nano spring batteries practical, scientists will need to assemble the nanotubes into longer and thicker fibers while still maintaining all the amazing benefits that they have at the small scale. Carol Livermore, associate professor of mechanical engineering, describes a major hurdle. She says these scaled-up springs need to be large, i.e. incorporating many carbon nanotubes. But those individual carbon nanotubes need to work well enough together in the overall assembly of tubes for it to have comparable properties to the individual tubes. That is not easy to do. So hopefully this will progress nicely, and we'll see some big changes in battery technology because we need it.
All right. Although, Bob, you left out a critical piece of information.
I read
this whole article. I didn't read the blurb at the top. And like you, I was sort of salivating the whole way through, but
yeah,
I kept waiting. So what's the capacity? You know, how much energy are we talking about? And then It says that potentially this can hold pound for pound as much as a state-of-the-art lithium-ion battery.
I know.
But that's just as much as a lithium-ion battery. No better. Come on.
I know. I remember that. I meant to throw that in there. It's funny because they throw this one thing out to you where they say that it's more power than 1,000 times the power of comparable springs with steel springs, and then in the very next sentence they say that it's just roughly equivalent to the
existing
conventional
technology. Thank you.
Yeah, it's like, well, that was kind of disappointing. I should have included that. Yeah, that was weird.
I mean, couldn't it have been 10 times as much? I mean, something.
Right.
No.
If we even 1.1 times.
But who knows? Maybe they'll be able to get more. You know, maybe this will there'll be a technology curve for this.
But Steve, it doesn't really matter that much because it's not just a matter of just the raw power. The fact that it could use all its power all at once, like a capacitor, or very slowly.
No, I get it. There are other advantages, but not the one we really need for things like electric cars, right? Maybe it might be a supplemental battery in an electric car, as you say.
Maybe. They also didn't mention how quickly we might be able to charge something like that. If you could charge it in 30 seconds, then, well, okay, that's pretty damn cool.
Yeah, that's true. Just a couple more quick items before we get on to a couple of questions. Jay, you're going to tell us about the latest shenanigans from Kirk Cameron.
Well, not just Kirk Cameron. It's also from our friend Ray Comfort.
Banana Man Ray Comfort.
Yeah, Banana Man. Bananas.
Ray Discomfort.
You know, everybody knows Ray Comfort is a known young Earth creationist. And in his ongoing attempt to thwart evolutionary theory and the education of evolution, what these couple of bozos...
And apparently to bring down the average intelligence of creationists.
Absolutely.
Which is no easy task.
Ray, along with his soulmate Kirk Cameron, have decided to give away 50,000 copies of Darwin's Origin of the Species. This is
really?
Isn't that interesting? But hold on, Evan.
Yeah.
I hope you're sitting down, my friend. This is to commemorate 150 years after the book was originally published. They're doing this on November 22nd of this year, 2009. The thorn in the side here is that Comfort has crafted a 50-page intro where he tries to discredit evolutionary theory, and some of the points that he tries to make is that, as if it matters, is that Darwin was a misogynist, that Hitler believed in evolution, and that there was a connection between Hitler and the theory of evolution. And then he also goes on to make all of the same exact logical fallacies that he's made over and over and over again. And a few comments that he made, which I thought were interesting, was a book can't spontaneously form, therefore evolution is wrong. He also says, all dumb scientists think everything came about after nothing exploded. And the other one said that Hitler was motivated by evolution. So, in my opinion, this is an attempt for Comfort to get his publication on college campuses into the books of students, especially young students, obviously, so he can influence them to see the alternate theory of creation.
The thing about Ray Comfort is that, you know, the guy really does not care about scholarship or factual accuracy or the truth or anything. He really is such an apologist for young Earth creationism. Really is terrible. It's an embarrassment.
And finally, you know, one thing I wanted to say to our listeners was that if anybody wants to organize trying to get their hands on these books or at least some of them, I think it would be a great thing for skeptics in the United States to do is to just try to get as many of these books in their hands. And, you know, a lot of people have blogged about this where they said, you know, just rip out the first 50 pages and you'll have a copy of it. I think it would be a great thing to keep intact and to hold on to. As a matter of fact, I would die for a copy of this.
Yeah, so any listeners who are going to be on college campuses when they're distributing these books, try to grab up as many as you can. If you don't mind, send us a copy. Yeah, it would be interesting to have a copy of it.
Well, but more importantly, I think it would be a good protest to go and take the books peacefully without getting into any confrontation. Get as many of them as you can.
And while I'm waiting for somebody to grab a copy and just dissect it to see what was added and what was deleted, what was taken out, and just to dissect it that way and see what did they do to it.
I would be surprised if there's one original thought in those 50 pages. I mean,
did you guys get a look at the video that girl made? That was one of the quickest video responses to the announcement of the passing out of these books. She calls the video Origin of Stupidity, and her YouTube username is ZomGitsChris. And I just loved her video. She did a great job of tearing apart the idea of this book. You know, it's only a 6-minute video, but she covered pretty good amount of material and did a good job of just tearing it down.
One more quick follow-up before we go on to a couple of letters. We reported previously about a homeopath, Thomas Sam, and his wife, Manju, who were arrested for the death of their young child who had a severe case of eczema. And the father, who's a homeopath, decided to treat the child only with homeopathic remedies. And as a result of that, she died a long, horrible, painful death, you know, from something that would have been completely treatable with standard medicine. The quick follow-up is that these parents, Thomas M. and Manju, were convicted and sentenced to a combined 10 years in jail. He's going to spend 6 years in jail at least, and she's going to spend 4 years in jail for the manslaughter by criminal negligence of their 9-month-old daughter, Gloria. So still a very sad story, but that's the follow-up on it.
You know, what could we say about things like this? I mean, everyone must have a similar reaction. Like, just unbelievable to think that parents would keep legitimate medical attention from their child and that they would literally just be giving that child water.
Yeah, and especially, it's even more heinous when you learn, when you go back and read the accounts of the story and so forth, the wife, Manju, when she apparently some time ago fell ill with something. She went and saw a real doctor. She didn't rely on the homeopathic remedies that she and her husband regularly dole out to the to people who don't know any better. No, she went and got real treatment, real medicine.
Yeah, that might be partly responsible, Evan, because the baby couldn't actually say, "Hey, I'm in pain. You know, I'm having trouble or anything." You know, the baby was just crying, I'd imagine. So yeah, you're right. It just brings that point even closer to home when you think about it. Like the actual negligence that took place here. This is one of those stories that makes it think that, you know, we really should start outlawing pseudoscience like this. I mean, if it's killing children, we should have laws against things like this.
Well, we've discussed this before. I mean, in various countries, there are systems in place to prevent either practicing medicine without a license or practicing essentially substandard, you know, quackery. The problem is that because of the alternative medicine movement has been successful in weakening these laws and in, you know, bamboozling enough of the public into thinking that this is actually an alternative, that things like this can happen. At least in this case, there was some measure of justice at the end.
Yep. I mean,
still doesn't solve the problem, but... Well, let's go on to a few of your questions. The first letter comes from Jason, who writes, "Hi, SGU, all the way from Sydney, Australia. I have a question which is probably more applicable to Stephen more than anyone else. As I understand it, your stance on the afterlife is agnostic. How do you deal with a patient who wishes to consult in you about the spiritual afterlife? It probably goes without saying that the patient's state of mind takes the utmost priority, so a debate is obviously out of the question. Such issues, however, have made me uncomfortable in the past, and as a young medical student, I would like to hear your take on how to talk to a patient through the matter, although not necessarily pretending that I share their beliefs in the afterlife. Thank you and keep up the great work. Jason." Yeah, this is certainly something that comes up. I mean, honestly, maybe not as much as you might think. You know, I've handed out terminal diagnoses quite often, and yet rarely do patients consult me for spiritual advice. I think they understand that that's not my role as their physician. The few times when patients brought up spiritual topics,
again, just in general, the physician's job is not to impose their belief system on the therapeutic relationship, on the patient. You don't really have to reveal your belief system to the patient. And you can talk about it in ways that you don't have to say flat out, you know, I'm not going to tell you or what you believe or what you don't believe. Certainly it is not your position to get into a debate about spiritual, you know, faith with a patient. You know, one very, I think, productive way to deal with that is just to ask them if they've talked about it with their family, you know, with their pastor, priest, you know, rabbi, whoever would be appropriate, you know, to discuss with them the need and the benefit for a support structure and for them to reach out to whatever support structure they have. And, you know, there may be new ones that you could offer to them, like patient support groups, et cetera. So that's where you just take the conversation to the practical question of, you know, in difficult times like this, you need some kind of social support structure to help you, you know, deal with the practical issues as well as the emotional issues. And so you very easily just sidetrack any direct questions. But honestly, no, it's, you know, after practicing as long as I have, no patient has directly confronted me and, like, really said, you know, I want you to tell me what your religious beliefs are. I think simply because it's sort of intuitive that it's not appropriate. Let's go on to the next question. This one is a little bit more fun. This one comes from Trinity Sean Melvin from Valparaiso, Florida. And Trinity writes, I recently purchased season one of Star Trek The Next Generation, and I'm loving it. It's particularly entertaining because every once in a while something happens in the show and I suddenly get a reference that you guys made but never quite understood until now.
Way to catch up.
Throughout the show, they scan planets and vessels for life signs or life forms. It got me thinking, knowing that chi and other such supposed life forces are scientifically untenable, is there some quality of living matter that sets it apart from non-living matter in such a way as to feasibly make it remotely discernible to some kind of instruments? It seems to work on reptilian species, so it doesn't rely on body heat or anything quite as simple as that. I know Star Trek is famous for the technobabble and does have its share of plain old impossibilities. But I'm curious about the plausibility of this aspect of the show. I'm guessing I'm asking exactly how far I actually need to suspend my disbelief in this case. Thanks a bunch, guys. I'm off to tell more friends about your show.
Ooh.
Thank you, Trinity. So yeah, this is kind of fun. This is purely speculative. I mean, certainly we've talked about the fact that for shows like Star Trek, you know, you do suspend your disbelief. There are plot devices, things that are necessary to drive the plot forward. They don't necessarily have to make technological sense. But it is a fun game to speculate about the way things might work or what is plausible and possible given what we know about the laws of physics, for example. So the question is, What is the theoretical mechanism by which, you know, on board the Starship Enterprise, you could quote unquote scan for life signs on another ship or on this surface of a planet, for example? You guys have any thoughts?
Movement. Animals move constantly.
Yeah.
So you could start with that, and then perhaps some other readings kick in right after that to just kind of verify that what is actually moving is giving off some sort of biosignature, whether it's a gas they're emitting or something.
Yeah,
movement was my first thought.
That's actually a good thought. I mean, given the level of our technology today, you extrapolate that into the future a couple hundred years, and it seems pretty, you know, plausible that you would be able to use some kind of a, you know, radar or Doppler, or just really, you know, a very powerful camera to scan for just physically moving objects. And then you could hone in on those, and then you could use infrared. Now, sometimes they do distinguish species by their temperature, for example. So it does seem that they're using some kind of a thermal, you know, infrared or whatever imaging.
Yeah, I would think that would be very, very big, very important. Although the Trinity is kind of discounting it in a way, but I think that would be big. I mean, clearly, lots of different species have a temperature range. I mean, even the reptiles. They wouldn't be at an environmental temperature necessarily, would they, Steve? I think you could even use it to perhaps distinguish the reptilian Gorn as well, couldn't we?
Well, certainly some reptiles are, you know, cold-blooded, and their temperature is the same pretty much as their environment. That doesn't necessarily mean that they wouldn't give off any heat.
But that would depend on how much energy they've absorbed then through the environment. So that would be very, very difficult for them. What about neuronal complexity somehow?
Well, yeah. So what signals do living things give off? They give off heat. They move.
Carbon dioxide.
They may be exhaling gases that could be potentially detectable through spectroscopy or some similar method. What about heart sounds? This is assuming the ability to detect tiny, tiny sounds from very, very far away.
Yeah, that is a tiny sound.
but not impossible.
Outside the atmosphere as well.
Yeah, but in terms of the technology, we're assuming that they're using some incredible technique, that we can only guess at, that will enable them to, listen in on vibrations in the atmosphere, sounds, and even triangulate to some specific object, even a small object very far away. That's not implausible. That just would require a certain amount of technological sophistication. But, the information is there and accessible. So thanks for the question, Trinity. I mean, highly speculative, but fun to talk about. One more quick email. This one comes from Lance Spengler, who gives his location as FOB Bucca, Iraq, or Iraq. FOB stands for Forward Operating Base, and this is a prison camp. It's a prison camp.
That could be a first for us.
And Lance Spengler, does that sound like a name you would make up for a military guy?
Yeah. Yes, it does say.
Colonel Lance Spengler.
FOB.
He writes, I'll try to keep this short. He doesn't really. But sure, you're a better correspondence. I'm new to podcasts, having purchased my iPod about 9 months ago, but it is a great medium. I have a broadcasting background and appreciate this new media and its potential. Here's the question, if you should ever have time for it on the air. A friend and I are arguing over the answer. You're flying along in a spacecraft at the speed of light. You have a light bulb in the ceiling of the fan. Can you see the light since its speed is relative to the speed of the craft? And taking it a step further, if you turn the spacecraft's headlights on, will they illuminate the asteroid just ahead of you? Or since the light being emitted has a relative forward speed of zero, based on the spacecraft speed, would it look as if the light wasn't even turned on? Okay, wacky question, but sometimes we have too much time on our hands here in the desert.
Well, one problem right off is physics itself has a problem with the premise. Initially, you're assuming that you're traveling at the speed of light, and that's the big problem because
you can't travel.
You can't travel at the speed of light. It would take infinite energy to get up there. And then, even if you can get exactly at the speed of light, you could argue that time doesn't exist at that speed. Like a photon. If a photon could know anything, it would know that it was created, and then it was absorbed at its destination. And whether there was a foot between those two events or a billion light years, it wouldn't make any difference because time essentially doesn't exist. So then you couldn't do anything if you were at the speed of light.
So let's say 99.9% of the speed of light.
Then the problem there would be that if the scientists on the ship would, say, measure the headlight speed, they would measure it as the speed of light.
Is the speed of light, exactly.
That's the law. The speed of light is invariable. To you, it always seems to be traveling at the speed of light, whether you're traveling a foot a second or 0.99999% of the speed of light. And then, of course, space-time kind of adapts itself so that works, so that when you do measure it, it does appear to be moving at the speed of light, even though you are traveling very close to the speed of light yourself. So special relativity, time dilation, all that comes into play.
Right. So and there's a couple different ways to explain this to help maybe bring it home. One is that you don't add speeds when you're talking about light, right? The speed, you don't add the speed of the light to the craft. The speed of light is always a constant. It always is the speed of light, regardless of your frame of reference. So here's the other thing. When you say you're moving at 99.9% the speed of light, that
relative
only has
what?
Meaning if you say relative to what? Relative to something. Any physical experiment that you did wouldn't be any different. The light in your cabin would work just as well. If there was an asteroid traveling ahead of you, light would be bouncing back and forth between you and the asteroid exactly the same. So in other words, that's the whole point of relativity, that there's no experiment you can do that would tell you what your uniform speed was, because it really doesn't have any meaning to say that you're traveling at any speed. It only does relative to something else.
Right.
And no matter what your frame of reference, the speed of light is the speed of light and behaves just like the speed of light.
That was one of Einstein's key insights right
yes,
there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go on with our interview. We are at TAM 7, and we're sitting here now with Mark Edward. Mark, welcome to the Skeptics Guide.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
And Mark is a magician and now a blogger. And
yes.
One of the members of the pilot, the Skeptologists, who unfortunately is stuck in the pilot phase. Part of what we're here is to get updated on what's going on with that. So, Mark, tell us about your career.
Okay. Well, I started off as a kid magician. My grandfather was a magician. And I was always very much interested in magic and illusion and the paranormal and the supernatural. It's always been in my life in one form or another. And being a magician, I got more interested in mentalism, which is a branch of magic, but it's not, you don't pull rabbits out of hats. You pretend to read minds and predict the future. And I found that was a much more sophisticated, if that's the right word, form of magic because people believed in it more. If you said you could turn a green handkerchief into a red handkerchief, it was, to me, what's the big deal? You know, there was no meaning to it.
Nobody really believes you're doing it.
Especially colorblind people who can't see red and green.
Yeah. I mean, people would see it and they go, oh, very clever, nice sleight of hand, next, you know. And I was very unsatisfied for many years, although I did rope tricks and card tricks and all that. But what really interested me is that if you change a dynamic by saying that there was magic with a K in it, or you referred to some bigger universe, suddenly people were standing in line for it and saying, wow, how did you develop your skills? And of course, my ego was charmed with that. I said, wow, this is different. Now people are coming to me and I don't have to struggle quite as much. If you worked in restaurants, it was kind of like being a bad mariachi player. You know, you come to the table and say, would you like to see some magic? And people were kind of like, well, okay, you know, but if you said, would you like a tarot reading? It's like, where's the line, you know? Where do we sign up for a tarot reading? So then through mentalism, I started doing readings, and I was a, quote, professional psychic, unquote, for about 9 years on the famed Psychic Friends Network, and I decided that I would infiltrate that. The whole time I was doing that, I was also very good friends with Michael Shermer and Skeptic Magazine. I was on the editorial board there. So I've been walking two very interesting lines, the skeptics and the believers, and I wanted to really infiltrate the soft, dark underbelly of the psychic world and try to work myself to the top of it just to see what that whole thing was about.
So during this time, though, to be clear, you were presenting yourself as a quote-unquote genuine psychic, not as a...
Oh, I never did disclaimer, no. Well, there were two sides of it. I did corporate parties and things like that where it was strictly entertainment. But then I had another side to my personality, which was where I was working in a spiritualist church, and I was absorbing as much woo as I could get, and it was very intense. It was, and they accepted me as one of them. With some of them, they were like the people who were very deluded, and then there were the people who were kind of the wink, wink, nod psychics who knew that I was kind of there for nefarious reasons, and they accepted me. So it was kind of like being in a sideshow for a while. It was very interesting.
Now, during this time, did you meet and talk with other people who were working as psychics?
Oh, absolutely.
Who were open to you about the fact that they knew it was all BS and they were doing mentalism, or was it always a secret that nobody talked about?
It was kind of a, like I say, a wink, wink, nod situation. The best way I can describe it is, if you know about carnies and carnivals, if you go down the Midway and they're doing the, you know, ball, penny a pitch, you know, step right up, fill the ring on the Coke bottle. If you say the term with it to them, that's the way it used to be, then they will automatically leave you alone because they know that you're with it and you're not going to fall for the con. So in the psychic world, there is kind of a tenuous understanding that way. They will not come up to you and say, hey, we know you're a phony just like us, but they know by your tone and your tenor and how you're presenting yourself, it's kind of a wink, wink, nod type of a thing. So, and I fell in with that lot because they never outwardly said, you know, you're a phony just like us, but it was understood.
Right.
So it's kind of a understood situation which is very comfortable because I was able to learn so much about what was going on, and they didn't hold back. There were other people who were kind of the other side of the camp, were the people who were the dyed-in-the-wool believers, but they were only being shepherded in so that they could become phonies. You know, there was kind of a, it was like going to psychic grad school. You know, you come in as a believer and you end making money, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and, but that in-between phase, some people knew, some people didn't. But the real pros that I met, they knew what they were doing.
How long did you do it for?
About 9 years. You know, 9 years of I was on the phone a lot, and I learned a lot doing that because what I tried to do is be honest with people. In other words, if I couldn't handle their problem, I would give out an 800 number and say, no, you really need to talk to a marriage counselor or an abuse shelter or something like that. Mm-hmm. Of course, the people who are running the company didn't like that very much.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, and then what happened is over the years, they started to put these restrictions on how you would talk and what you would say. And I finally said, you know, I can't do this. This is unethical. So I just grew a conscience and said, forget it.
What was the reaction of the people that you told to, hey, go to a marriage counselor for this type of thing?
Were they usually said, well, what's the number? You know, they said, really? What's a woman's shelter? You know, they had no idea. They were like I had one woman, she said, well, I got a problem. And I said, what? And she said, well, my boyfriend gouged my eye out. And I'm like, really?
You know? Wow.
And she said, can you tell me what to do? And I said, you need to call a woman's shelter. And she was like, what's that? And so it was amazing. I mean, the amount of things that I had during those years that were just people looking for help. But they didn't know where else to turn.
Is that about the most severe thing you ever heard in your years of doing that?
Oh, terrible things. Terrible. Much worse than that. One time, and this is why, I went back and forth about whether it was of value or not, is because, you know, I saved somebody's life one time. And it was very interesting because I was on the line. It was late at night, early in the morning. And a woman called. And I was, frankly, I'd been on for about 7 hours straight on the telephone. So I was kind of like, give her a stock reading, get rid of her. So I kind of blew her off, you know, gave her a stock reading. She disappeared, and about 3 months later, I got a phone call from the president of the company, vice president of the Psychic Friends Network, the woman who was the trainer. She said, do you remember this woman, whatever her name was, blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, I don't, not really. Do you remember this night, this call, this minute? And I said, no. And she said, well, we just want you to know that she had a gun to her head, and she was going to commit suicide. But what you told her, she changed her mind, and now she's going to school, and she's taking nursing, and she's turned her whole life around. And I was like, but I had given her just a general reading. So, you know, so the power of that, I think, stuck with me for a long time.
Oh, my God.
It's intense. A good thing you chose reading C instead of reading E.
Yeah, right? No kidding.
You would have had a different outcome.
Yeah, I mean, if I had tried to really understand her, she might have hung up the phone and blew her head off. So, I mean, these are the – and there are things like that that happen frequently. So, for me, it was a really interesting couple of years because I got to the bottom of the business and I saw the very worst. But I also saw that there was something going on there that was of value. Mm-hmm. You know, it was because it was the poor man's therapy. Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting way of looking at
it. Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. Did you ever do the bit where you're like, hello?
Oh, yeah.
We are here to help you. Like super slow talking.
Yeah. Well, but the thing is, I didn't have to because after a while, the company made all these ways that they could make money. In other words, you started getting charged as soon as you call the company. And then they had all these commercials and different things, choose your psychic. So a standard caller, they would – and by the way, I can only say these things because the 10 years has passed. I had to sign a confidentiality agreement with the company. And so now – and my book, Psychic Blues, it's all there, Psychic Friends. You should buy a copy if – Deanne Warwick, are you out there listening?
Yeah, right.
Want to read your story? I have it in print now. So, you know, they made up all these rules that were very manipulative. And I could reveal some of those, but maybe not now.
Yeah, but what about Miss Cleo? Come on.
I had nothing to do with her.
But she's the real deal.
What do you see in the what do you see? What do you see in the Two of Cups, baby?
No, I managed to get in right on the ground floor. I think it was like 94 or something when it was just burgeoning. And they started off, they thought they only needed about, I think, 100 psychics, and it went to like 1,000 in the 1 year. Wow. And they were making literally millions of dollars. So anyway, that's part of my past.
They're still around? I don't hear about psychic
No, it's all because what it is it became and became such a gigantic Frankenstein monster that they got top-heavy and greedy, and they ended up getting a lot of lawsuits, and they finally went bankrupt.
Okay.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
That was predictable.
Yeah.
When you revealed, did you just stop doing it, or did you actually tell people, hey, I don't believe in any of this stuff?
No, I would never say I didn't believe it, because I didn't think it was had anything to do with belief. It was just like, you know, I believe in gravity. If I drop something on the table, it's going to hit the table. So yeah. People have issues, you know. And my thing was, I would just be totally honest with them. Like, a lot of people would just call up and they'd say, I need lotto numbers. That's all I need. Make it quick. And
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
I'd say, well, here's your lotto numbers. Goodbye. You know, and then they'd call back. I didn't win. I said, well, you didn't ask me you wanted winning lotto numbers. You just can't. In other words, I played with them so that I let them know that I wasn't serious about it.
Yeah.
And by not being serious, because so many of the other people I worked with, they were just very doom and gloom, and you know,
yeah. They're
totally deluded. And I would hear, because they gave us a chance sometimes to tune into the other people and what they're talking
about.
And I just couldn't believe it. So I decided I was going to be the honest psychic, and I was not going to say if they challenged me. And to me, one of the best parts was when I would get a skeptic, because I love getting a skeptic call, because I'd carry a conversation with them, and I wouldn't always win them over, but I had certain times where, you know, I liked the challenge, and I liked to be able to kind of, and also they had a thing where they would do a drop-in listens. In other words, the person who is a supervisor, you wouldn't know it, but they'd be listening to your call.
Oh.
Yeah, so you had to be kind of careful what you said.
This call may be randomly recorded.
That's right. But I actually liked that, too, because I skirted the very borders of, you know, being a skeptic psychic. In other words, I just took it right to the edge where I didn't say I was anything, but I didn't say I wasn't either. So that kind of inculcated this mindset that I was walking both realms at the same time.
Did everything really funny happen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you would have what my ex-wife and I, we both worked on this line, and we would call them ringers. And ringers were like just these stories that were stranger than any fiction you could imagine. And they would be so crazy that we had to sit down and write them. And later on, I went back over them and made this book, Psychic Blues. So, I mean, yeah, there were just...
Can you give us one?
I had one guy who, he had this phobia that there were tiny little scissors everywhere.
Whoa.
Everywhere he went, they were under his pillow. I found another pair of scissors today. And I said, well, what do they look like? And he said, well, they're just miniature scissors.
Nano scissors.
And someone's trying to gaslight me. So I feel like someone's putting them there for a reason to make me crazy. And he called me about 4 or 5 times. And I said, where are the scissors today? And he said, they were in my juice bottle at work. You know what I mean? Stuff like that.
But then somebody like that needs to be on medication.
Yeah.
They need to see a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
That's schizophrenic or something.
Well, yeah, that's what I said. Are you seeing a therapist? Are you, you know, is this, are you taking LSD? You know, I tried to ask them what's going on. And that was what was sometimes very strange, is they showed no outward signs of anything except that delusion. You know, I work in a bank, and I'm married, and I've got 3 kids. It's just the scissors, you know.
Damn.
Stuff like that.
Steve, so that really, obviously,
that's a
psychosis.
That's a psychotic disorder.
Yeah.
I mean, high-functioning psychotic disorder in that person. But you never said something like, yeah, your spirit guide is telling me that you
can see
a psychiatrist.
No, like, I would never
do anything like that.
Well, you know, that would be I just never went to that level because I did not want to make it sound like, because somebody like that who's obviously delusional, you don't need to give them another delusion, you know? I tried to actually backtrack and say, I'd say, oh, this, you know, I think I told a guy one time, this is not that unusual, you know? Because you don't want them to think that you're making fun of them.
Yeah.
You can't like go, what are you, nuts, you know?
Yeah. So what are you doing now?
Now I'm trying to get this skeptologist show off the ground. I'm really very frustrated. I'm trying to push... We have a blog site. It's called www.skepticblog.org, and I'm pushing this agenda of ambush skepticism, guerrilla skepticism, because my background before I was a magician and a mentalist, my degree is in art, and my degree was in performance art. So I used to do street theater and performance art, and I really want to find a way to get out into the culture and cause some trouble with skepticism so we can get in the public eye and people can say, my goal is to kind of be like the Andy Rooney of the paranormal,
mm-hmm.
you know, and have it so people think, what's going to happen this week with those skeptic people, you know? It's kind of like Greenpeace, only not like Greenpeace,
yeah.
but an activist group mm-hmm. that's visible, that people who are like, you know, the phony psychic Sylvia and all her ilk wonder, you know, they might be in the crowd tonight. What are they going to do?
Yeah.
And plan things like that so that it becomes visible. And a lot of humor. I think humor is really important. So I do that. I'm writing another book right now. I have a lot of books on theory of mentalism and how to be effective performer. So
you still perform?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I have. But I have to say the mentalism side is kind of slow right now.
Is it?
Yeah, and ever since 9/11, the whole seance business is just... I think I've had maybe 3 seances where I used to do probably 2 or 3 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And after 9/11, for some reason, it just dropped off.
Wow, I wouldn't have thought of that.
I think people, it's not... I mean, calling back the dead is not as fun as it used to be. You know, I think people have kind of a... different take on it, you know. So, but I still do seances. I try to do those as much as possible because for me, that's really the acting where the acting role comes in.
You do that. The people that are attending the seance, are they doing it like a party, like as a piece of entertainment, or do they believe?
Oh yeah. Well, I don't do. I tell people, you know, I don't do real, quote unquote, real seances. I tell people, you know, I can do that, but it'll cost you a lot more money.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And that usually scares them away because when I first started doing it, I did try a couple of those just to see what it was like, and it was pretty ugly. I didn't feel that I was in my realm. So I tell people it's for entertainment and it's done as a, you know, I have to. Pick a specific entity like Jimi Hendrix or Jim Morrison or, you know, Michael Jackson. Any Michael Jackson takers out there listening? You know, and then you tailor the seance to that person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a party thing.
Yeah, that sounds like a really a lot of fun.
It's great. I mean, people love it. But once again, I don't know why, but it's not doing too well in that market, right?
Of the world of mentalists, who, in your opinion, is the best one out there?
Ah, Geller.
That's surprising, but good question, but good answer.
I mean, but Stephen, he's kind of fallen off. But I think, I mean, if you've ever seen Yuri work a room, he is absolutely stupendous.
Yeah.
And I would never I call him a magician or a mentalist. He wouldn't call himself that. But but as a performer, I think that he's probably, I mean, look, he changed the whole way we look at silverware.
Yep.
You know, and I mean, there hasn't been anybody like that since. And
I've never seen him bend a spork, though.
A spork. Yeah.
Did they make metal sporks?
It must be very interesting, though, for someone like you to be in the room with him because, I mean, you see what he's doing. Like, you know, you
right.
and Randy. Like,
I appreciate
you
what
know,
he
yeah,
does. I actually appreciate what he does. Whereas, I mean, most skeptics are like, oh, that, you know, he's reprehensible. But I see it in a totally different light. I see it as a very keen manipulator who knows how to take advantage of every possible moment, and that's key to being a good mentalist or medium. Is you have to understand the dynamics of a room right away,
mm-hmm.
and know where to focus and where to back off, and that's the real work. You know, the tricks are icing on the cake. The real thing is the mindset.
Yeah,
he's got that down.
Now, when you do seances, do you do purely like mentalism seances? It's just all in your performance, or do you add any physical elements like noises or anything like that?
Yeah, I do. I do add in. I have a. It depends on the venue and how much, you know, those things add on to the bill. You know, in other words, I have a walk in, walk out seance that I do, which is the base rate. Then I add things on. I talk to the host and I say, do you want to have background noise? Do you want to have picture frames tilt? Do you want, and it adds on, you know?
Yeah.
Mark, can you show us something, anything? I hate to ask you, I know, but I'm such a huge fan of magic and everything. If you have anything, I'd love
to. Sure, well, let's try to contact the spirit of Michael Jackson.
Let's do it.
All right, so.
Rebecca, join us.
Yeah, we need everybody to link hands on the table just real quick here, and I'm going to maybe put the water in the center because we don't want to, if the table starts to go over to the ceiling or something, we want to be sure that there's no. Okay, now I want you to lay your hands flat on the table.
Yeah.
And I want you to just touch your little fingers. What we're forming here is this is called the psychic circle.
Okay, so we have our hands flat on the table with our palms down.
Now, if we could, we can't turn the lights out, can we?
I can do it.
Yeah, just get up for a second. Can you make it back to your chair to be able to see?
Oh, yeah, I can do it.
Okay, because the spirits work best in the darkness. We all know that. I mean, you know. Yeah, so that's perfect. Well, we do have the exit sign, but that's actually
good enough, yeah.
Red light is good, okay? Now, as I said, you may feel things. Once we start this brief seance, you may feel things. You may sense things. You know, you may feel a light touch on your shoulder or a cold breeze or something like that. So don't be afraid, because the spirits are all here to entertain us. They mean no harm. And Michael Jackson, you know, he was a gentle soul. And if the worst that can happen is maybe some cookies and milk will materialize in the center of
the
table.
Yes.
Okay, so relax. Everyone take a deep cleansing breath. Spirits, we are here at TAM 7. I feel that you are near us in this room. I feel that you are reticent to make yourself known, but now is your chance, because we're all waiting. So spirits, can you reach beyond the veil? The whale. No, maybe there's a whale trying to come through. Reach beyond the veil and reach towards Michael Jackson, MJ. Are you there? Can you speak to us? Can you give us a physical sign? Give us a sign. Speak to us. One rap for yes, two for no. MJ, are you here? Oh, wow.
Wow.
I think that was a yes.
I think he's pissed off.
Yes, he's here.
He sounds a little angry.
He's telling me that he is here. He's telling the family now. This is going out to the family. He does not want to be buried under tons of concrete to keep his body from being stolen by gravediggers. Is that true, Michael? Is that the message? Yes.
Can you ask him if he's angry at me for predicting his death?
Michael, are you angry for any of the psychics who have predicted your death?
Oh, good.
No.
Good.
Feel better.
So, spirits, we are on a very tight time element right now. So I bid you to be gone. Leave this room. Ghostly spirits, ghouls or fiends, nevermore be thou convened. Shepherd's wort and holy rite, vanish thee into the night. You may break the psychic circle.
Ah.
Turn the lights on.
Oh. Annie, can you hear me? That's hardcore.
That was a thriller.
You can see how easy it is.
I see what you did there.
Now, did anyone feel anything? Did anyone see
I felt
anything?
Two pinkies.
There you go. That's
I felt three pinkies. Is that weird?
That's really weird.
Oh, Rebecca.
Yeah, I could see, you know.
That wasn't a pinky.
It's so cliche, and it's obvious. You know, the lights go down.
Right.
You speak in a commanding voice.
Yes.
You know, you create the tone. I mean, if you have any kind of true belief about this type of thing,
right,
you're already in the zone.
That's right.
The darkened room, you know, the mood changes. Hey, Mark, I wanted to tell you that, you know, we at the SGU, we've been working on our mentalism skills very well, and we have achieved something that we think is quite remarkable, and we're about to make a demonstration for you.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. I have changed the frequency of sound in this room. Okay, don't be afraid.
Okay, everyone.
Say your name. This is Steve. This is Bob. This is Evan. This is Mark. And this is Rebecca. Rebecca, all I want to hear you say is hot pockets.
Hot
pockets. Coming out. Okay.
And we're back.
We're back.
Oh. Okay. Wow.
That was tricky.
That felt hardcore. Ectoplasm choking. Yeah.
Well, ectoplasm vibrates at a different frequency than air.
That's true. Absolutely.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that in chemistry.
Obviously.
Damn it.
Right. There we go.
Oh, man.
Well, Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you.
Mark.
Anytime you want to call on me about any subject in this area, I'd be happy to fill you in.
Cool.
Awesome. Fantastic.
Watching for the skeptologist or something like it.
Yeah, good luck with
cool.
that.
Awesome. Yeah. I'll say the same to you, Steve.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks,
Mark.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Everyone ready for this week?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Si, senor.
And here we go. Item number one. Researchers find that hyenas significantly outperformed chimpanzees in a test of cooperative problem solving.
Now, here we go.
Item number two. New research finds that Scandinavians are descended from local populations that have lived in the region for at least a million years. And item number three, a new study shows that negative subliminal messages are more effective than positive subliminal messages. Evan, go first.
Well, hyenas significantly outperforming chimpanzees in a test of cooperative problem solving. I don't know about that. Significantly outperformed. The next one was the new research about Scandinavians descending from local populations. Wow, a million years is a long time. That one doesn't seem right either. I think two of them are fiction, and let's see what the last one says. Negative subliminal messages are more effective than positive subliminal messages. Well, that's plausible. I mean, that's certainly possible. All three might be fiction. But that's not the case. All right, I'll say the subliminal messages statement is fiction.
Okay, Bob?
The chimpanzees and hyenas, yeah, that does seem a bit bizarre. I mean, the cooperative aspect of it, I think, might sway it into believability. If it was just a lone hyena being more intelligent than a lone chimpanzee, then I think that would clearly be wrong. But because it's cooperative, I think it's feasible. The subliminal messages, yeah, it seems right to me that a negative message would be more jarring and have more impact than something that was positive. So that kind of makes sense as well. The Scandinavians, though, local populations from a million years? No, it seems way too long. I'm going to say that is fiction.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, I'd agree with Bob about the hyenas and the chimpanzees on the point that if it was a single hyena, I wouldn't think it could outperform the chimpanzee. But you know, you see hyenas working together, and I've read about that a lot and how complicated their interaction is, especially like in the teamwork. I just don't know. I don't have enough information about that. New research finds that Scandinavians are descended from local populations that have lived in the region for at least a million years. A million years, right, Evan?
That's a long time.
Yeah, that raises a flag. I'm not too comfortable with the million years bit. And the last one, a new study shows that negative subliminal messages are more effective than positive subliminal messages. When we're talking about like what kind of subliminal messages, how are they delivered? Are they, you know, are they heard? Are they read?
Subliminally.
In general, people are more likely to believe a negative comment about them than a positive one. I don't know. Maybe no. Now that just flip-flopped in my head now. Now that I think about it. I'll just say I think the middle one's the fake about the Scandinavians.
So you all agree that researchers find that hyenas significantly outperform chimpanzees in a test of cooperative problem solving is science, and that is, in fact, science.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And you're right. I think the thing that really clinched it was the cooperative problem solving. This was a specific test. I said a test of cooperative problem solving. What they did was they had a platform with two ropes attached to it, and on top of the platform was meat and bone chips, right? It was food. The thing is, you had to pull the two ropes at the same time, and you had to pull on them hard. Researcher Christine Drea from Duke University found that within moments, you know, minutes really, of the two hyenas being put into the test cage, they figured out how to, you know, simultaneously pull on the rope to get the food. And she said her jaw dropped when she was, they just did it immediately. The chimpanzees took a lot longer, and they had a harder time working together. What she suspects is that any cooperative pack-hunting mammal needs to be able to work together like this. So they suspected that, you know, the pack-hunting hyenas, you know, might be good at this sort of cooperative problem-solving. But also, she thinks that, you know, pulling on the ropes at the same time is a lot like pulling down prey. And in order for hyenas to pull down a bigger prey, they need to, you know, pull down on it at the same time. So this is a task that they might be particularly well suited to.
That's amazing. I mean, to think that they did that in a matter of a few minutes?
Less than 2 minutes.
Oh, my God. I mean, I don't think that me and a friend would have figured it out that fast.
Right. Yeah, Jay, you would have been there for. You'd still be there.
Yeah. And I'll be starving too.
Let's go on to number two. New research finds that Scandinavians are descended from local populations that have lived in the region for at least 1 million years. Jay and Bob, you think that one is the fake. Evan, you think that one is real. And that one is
tricky
fiction.
Bastard.
No, you see, I said they were all fiction, so I'm actually not wrong there.
Yeah, whatever.
Go back and replay it.
You know, this gets to the two competing hypotheses, you know, out of Africa versus the regional hypothesis, the multi-regional hypothesis, and that, you know, there is some suggestion that there may have been local populations that were stable, and that even though there were sort of later waves of more modern humans, like from Africa into Europe, they then would interbred with the local populations and retained the local genetic features. You know, so, you know, Asians were Asians, even if you go back to Java Man, right? If you go back to Homo erectus. And
enjoy this call.
Maybe the same was true of other regions like Scandinavia. But the out-of-Africa hypothesis has definitely been, I think, predominating recently.
Yeah.
The other piece of information you could bring to bear is, you know, how old is the human species, Homo sapiens? And estimates now are about Homo sapiens split from Homo neanderthalensis about 500,000 years ago, about half a million years ago in Africa. The news item that inspired this was a study, a genetic study that showed that Scandinavians are in fact descended from Stone Age immigrants only from thousands of years ago. After the development of agriculture, probably something on the order of magnitude of 4,000 or so years ago. So basically Stone Age immigrants, quite the opposite of a million years.
Yeah, they have actually quite an amazing homogeneous gene pool, don't they? They're doing some genetic studies on them, and it's an incredible pool to study.
Yeah, which means the, you know, the homogeneity, the similarities, you know, in the genetics, that implies a recent small founder population.
Right.
All of this means that a new study shows that negative subliminal messages are more effective than positive subliminal messages is, in fact, science.
Science.
And this one, you know, caught my attention, too, because I wasn't really convinced that there's any legitimacy to subliminal messaging. It's still a little controversial, and it also, I guess, depends on exactly what you're doing. You know, not all subliminal messages are created equal. What this study did was they flashed words on a screen for very short fractions of a second. For example, 1/50th of a second in some cases. And the words were either negative, like agony, despair, murder, positive, like cheerful, flower, and peace, or neutral, like box, ear, or kettle. The question was, does the emotionality of the word affect the participant's ability to respond to what they saw? They didn't ask them to say what the word was. They just said, was the word that was flashed up emotionally positive, negative, or neutral? That was all that they were asked. And they were also asked, well, how certain are you of it? Interestingly, they were able to guess that the words had a negative emotional implication more accurately than a neutral or positive one, even when they felt they were guessing randomly, when they didn't feel as if they had seen anything and they had no confidence essentially in their answer, they still guessed negative words correctly more often than positive, which is very interesting. This indicates that there may be some, you know, rapid subconscious visual processing. And in fact, this, you know, dovetails with some recent other evidence showing that, in fact, there are visual processing pathways that do not necessarily invoke conscious awareness of what we're seeing. The purpose of this is probably to be able to react very quickly to emotional visual stimuli without necessarily having to go through the slower, full conscious processing of it so that we could react quickly to certain things.
You think that would be more of a survival tactic, like from bodily harm, or?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, just seems that the pathways though might be there, and they are able to function even for things like words.
Yeah.
Evan,
Doctor,
who's that noisy?
Oh boy!
Let's play it again for those who forgot from last week.
So what was that sound, Evan?
That was the sound of, if you can believe it or not, That is the sound recording of someone breathing who has fluid in their lungs.
Yikes. That would have been me for the past 2 weeks.
You'd be surprised at how long it took me to find that on the internet.
Oh, you looked for that? You actually said, I want to find that sound, and you sought it out?
It was one of the biological sounds I was actually looking for, and it took me a while, but I did eventually find it.
Huh.
The closest person to guessing correctly was Sea Otter, who guessed that it was the sound of breathing through a stethoscope. Hmm. So that's close.
Close-ish.
It wasn't exactly what I was looking for.
Well, it was good. Good guess.
So I'm going to give it to Sea Otter, because it's within my power to do so.
Well, congratulations.
Well done, Sea Otter. And now, for the moment you've been waiting for this week, some of you have skipped over the rest of the podcast to get to this very moment, and I shall keep you waiting no longer. Here is this week's Who's That Noisy?
That's a perfect example of what he did last night. He sounded smooth and polished and strong and convincing, and what he was selling was snake oil. That is a completely bogus claim.
All right.
Good noise there, Evan.
Yeah, so try to figure out who that is and let us know.
And who's he talking about?
Well.
And what did he have for dinner?
That's the double whammy. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I certainly do, Steve. This is a quote that is, I tried to validate it, and it is accredited to Theodore E. Woodward, but it...
Oh, Teddy Woodward.
Theodore E. Woodward was actually... mostly known for winning a Nobel Prize.
This wasn't one of the characters from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
I don't remember that.
Theodore E. something.
He found cures for typhus and typhoid fever. And he was a renowned University of Maryland in Baltimore researcher in the field of medicine. And he said, when you hear hoofbeats behind you, don't expect to see a zebra. Theodore Woodward!
Now, there's other variations of that quote. When you
Theodore Woodward!
When you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. Right. And, of course, that was used by...
Arthur Conan Doyle.
Those words were put in the mouth of Sherlock Holmes, who I think might have embellished it a little bit to say, if you hear hoofbeats on the streets of London, think horses, not zebras. And that is a famous quote in the medical profession. In fact, we call rare medical diagnoses zebras after that comment.
Steve, It's amazing. I got this quote from a listener, and I should give that listener credit right now, and I shall. That quote was sent in by Nick Farantello from Orlando, Florida. Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
It blows me away that I didn't give you any time, any forewarning about what the quote was going to be, and you jumped on it and have all this amazing information at your fingertips like that. That was virtually zero research on your part.
Jay, I'm a physician. That's a famous quote to physicians.
Steve's been he's been using that in his lecture for 12 years.
I'm just saying. Just saying.
I also took a course in medical school on Sherlock Holmes.
Did you?
We used the stories of Sherlock Holmes as a way of teaching clinical decision-making. You know, we would read a story, we would not get the ending, we would have to figure out the answer, and then we would make an analogy between the kind of logic we had to use this to solve the Sherlock Holmes mystery to a diagnostic question. It was a great course. It was an awesome course. We haven't plugged our other various online activities in a while, so if you're listening to this show, you might also want to listen to the SGU 5x5, a short format, single topic podcast safe for the classroom and for children. You may want to join the lively discussions of our episodes and other topics in science and skepticism on our forums, which you can again get to from the SGU website. You can read our various blogs, Neurologica, which is my personal blog about neurology, critical thinking, and general science and skepticism, Science-Based Medicine, which is a group medical blog, The Rogues Gallery, which is the official blog of the SGU, and Skeptic Blog, which is the official blog of the Skeptologist. So thank you for joining me again this week.
Surely.
Oh.
Right.
I had nothing better to do.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.